Welcome to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. Today, we present part two of our two-part series on the 50th anniversary of the Kent State shootings. On last week's program, we heard from a survivor of the shootings and the sister of one of the students killed that day, Laurel Krause. This week, we'll hear from four activists and academics, each with a perspective to share about what Kent State means today. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. Half a century has now gone by since May 4th, 1970, the day that Ohio National Guard troops killed four students and wounded nine more during an anti-war protest at Kent State University in Ohio. Owing to the coronavirus pandemic, plans for in-person commemorative events at the campus this year had to be canceled. Instead, Project Censored took part in an online teach-in about the Kent State attacks and their impact on history. Today we bring you part two of our Project Censored series on the Kent State Massacre at 50. We'll hear excerpts from interviews that I did with four academics and anti-war activists about the continuing influence of Kent State today. For the full 4 hours of these interviews, please see truthtribunal.org. Here's part of my conversation with Joel Ice, who told me about what was going on in 1970 in Fresno, California, where he was very active in the labor and anti-war movements, especially around draft resistance. He spoke about the disconnect between what U.S. media told the general public about the war and what students learned on campuses.
Back in the day when all this happened at Kent State and Jackson State, Mississippi, I was deeply involved in politics at the time, in radical politics. I lived in Fresno, California. At that particular period of time, it was more important than one would think. First of all, it had been a union organizing center for the grape strike. The Farm Workers Theater was there. I was a member of Farm Workers Theater. I was the production manager and an actor in the company at that time, running from the cops, trying to finish the play in the park, which is what that was about. I was deeply involved with the draft movement. I lived at the draft resistance house at the time. Fresno was an epicenter for that because California only had three induction centers, one in LA, I think, one in Oakland, and one for some reason in Fresno, which was in the Central Valley. But that made us pretty much ground zero for a lot of stuff. We would leave in front of the induction center, which was right there. The press was always there. David Harris, who started the National Draft Resistance, and Mary Joan Baez was from Fresno, California. I actually was a friend of his in high school. By pure chance, all of these confluence of things that happened, and politics on the campus, which was very important. I won't go into that, but there were some big issues at Fresno State. We found ourselves at a whirlwind center, not of our making, not of our choosing. We organized a march from the free speech area from Fresno State out to the main street of town, and we had over 2,000 people there. That period of time, there were something like 800 or 900 colleges in America that went out on strike within a day or so of the bombing of Cambodia and the murders of Kent and Jackson State. There were 900 campuses. Over a million people went on strike in the colleges. We had about 2,000 people at Fresno, which tells you how active that area was. It was a very conservative area, agricultural students, farmers' kids, fraternities were a big deal. And to get students, young people in that community, in that environment, that concern, will show you how much of an upheaval that situation was. So that was where I was at that particular moment in time.
How has the May 4, 1970 Kent State massacre influenced the collective of our society, maybe from then to now?
Good question. It's hard to describe to people who weren't there what that was like. They all get these ideas that it was only paisley clothes and music and free-flowing drugs. And I won't say that wasn't there, but I will say for people involved in politics, that was a side issue. All of those things were part of a cultural revolution, which was a result of the bankruptcy of our values and how those values were being acted out by the dominant society. That became personal, family by family. In my case, and many other people, My dad was in World War II. He had no concept that the government could do anything except defend the country. He grew up in a leftist household. I grew up in third generation leftist household. Nonetheless, he went to war and defended the country. And he just could not wrap his mind around the reality that we were being used. The worst thing to tell an American was that they're being used. They'd rather shoot you than admit they were being used, which is exactly what happened at Kent State and Jackson State. My dad, I came home one day and said to me, if you burn your draft card, you're no son of mine. So I got up and walked away from the table and hadn't to talk to him for over a year thereafter. This was a family by family kind of civil war, cultural revolution. To put it in context in terms of the degree to which the average American mind was separated and disconnected from the reality they were facing, we had these things at the time called the hard hat riots. These were ordinary, working class people, working guys, were so upset at the hippies that they would go out and spontaneously beat the crap out of anybody with long hair. It was becoming a bit of a national sport. The odd thing was, you would stop any one of these guys individually and they'd say, well, I want my kids to have a better life than I did. I want them to go to college. Then when their kid would go to college and come home and tell them all the things their government hadn't told them about the realities of the world they were living in, they'd throw the kid out of the house. They couldn't connect the value of the size of information that was coming into people at university as the other side of the information they weren't getting from the national media. They just couldn't accept the fact that they were being used. Most Americans don't realize that in those days, all the news that came into the newspapers went through the State Department first. It went to the State Department, then went out on the wire service. If the State Department didn't want you to see it, they just ripped it off the wire, and the newspapers never got it. The only way you could get that information was by reading the foreign press, the Guardian or the French Liberation papers, and that was the source of that information at the time. So we were getting that information because we knew we were not getting the truth from our government. If you went back and told your dad that was what was happening, he threw you out of the house. So we had a class distinction in terms of a generational distinction. In terms of Kent State and the university situation, you had working class kids going to the school and you had other people. So on the one hand, you had a person who would say, I want my kids to go to college, but they didn't want to hear what college kids were telling them. They couldn't face it. So you had guys at Kent State, you had guys at the other schools that were cops, that were National Guardsmen, that couldn't stand the fact that they'd been to NAM or that one of their friends was at NAM and that they were being used. The veterans movement, men who were coming back from Vietnam, telling the realities, was getting the headlines at the time, and they were turning to their buddies in the National Guard and saying, hey, Frank, what you read on the recruiting poster is in fact wrong. I was there. I was in the trenches. That's not what's going on. And they couldn't handle that. And as anybody knows who's gone into an argument with somebody who's about to be proven wrong, that's when they get really intense. And that was what was happening. Problem is, these guys were armed with rifles. We knew something was going to give because there were more police arrests and all the rest of that stuff. And it blew at Kent State, which was in the middle of the country. They figured it would happen at Berkeley or Columbia, one of those places. The fact that it happened at a school of such a supposedly safe common denominator indicates the depth and the level at which the government disconnected. Most of the students in that demonstration didn't even realize that they were being taken that seriously by the other side. The idea that they would be shot at was something they really couldn't accept. Of course, if you were a black person in America at that time, getting shot at was pretty normal. The number of black people killed in that same week by police violence across the country was probably double or triple. I don't remember the newspapers. The first time that I had a gun pulled on me at a demonstration was in 1968 at the strike at San Francisco State, which was the biggest, most violent strike in the country. It was a strike for third world rights for the ethnic studies program. You came to campus on the days of the strike. There were 600 police officers. They had huge billy clubs. The first time that the cops ever had huge billy clubs. They came through the campus on horses, beating people up, literally on horseback, like Cossacks in World War I. On the roof of the building were police officers with machine guns. So this was the way you were supposed to go to college. Same cops on the roof with the machine guns who were calling us, you know, irresponsible students, were putting their money away so their kid could go to college. That's what that world was like. The more information that came out that made it clear that the Vietnam War was a colonialist grab, the more intense was the reaction of trying to shut us up. There was a report that came out in the 50s by Shell Oil, which is a Dutch oil company, put out by the French, which we were never shown until the 70s. That report, which was given to the federal government, showed that there were huge oil reserves in the China Sea off Vietnam and huge reserves of iron ore and uranium in the mountains of Vietnam. That's what the war was about. We were told it was about democracy. It was about the grabbing national resources before the Chinese could get in there. And that was it.
As you clearly just laid out the reasoning behind Vietnam, we've seen one invasion after another, one issue after another. All the wars of after 9/11 were allegedly to stop terrorism. But again, look at the countries that we've been invading. It's about natural resources. So how do we make peace with what happens at something like Kent State? Political and human rights are still under assault. What are some lessons to take from history?
After the end of the Vietnam War, the government learned its lesson. The lesson they learned was not to publicize what they were doing. All of the wars after that, Bob Woodward wrote a book called Veil about the small guerrilla wars fought by the CIA slush funds, where they would go in, destabilize the government, and then go in and liberate the country, take over the government. It happened in Chile, it happened in Grenada, it happened in lots of countries. What this means is that the government learned to change its tactics. That's been the history of what the government learned from that situation. They also turned around and internalized those policies in terms of treating the internal population as a disenchanted population to be internally disorganized. More disinformation, more CIA, and the assault from the press on internal movements started back in the labor movement in the late 20s, but it really got going here. This is an important phrase to comprehend. With the speed of information being gathered and disseminated by both legitimate and illegitimate organizations, it became clear to the right wing and their supporters very quickly that it was possible around the time of the Kent State massacre to reinterpret history while it was happening. They could choose to point the camera where they wanted and give it a background title that supported that narrative. They would point a camera at totally innocent students and say, these students were waiting to bomb a building. At no time in the entire anti-war movement was a leaflet put out by the left wing ever directly quoted so that people could hear what it was we actually had to say. It was always reinterpreted by somebody in a suit. And I saw that occur when I challenged a news reporter in a demonstration. I said, take this leaflet and quote it. He said, oh, I won't do that. I said, you don't have the courage. He did it. He showed up on the front line at a demonstration the next week. He had been fired by his own newspaper for quoting the actual words of the people who were demonstrating. And that's what that kind of process of reinformation, of, you know, rehashing the information became. It was a conscious campaign of reinterpreting history while it was happening.
Joel Ice, I couldn't agree more. At Project Censored, I mean, that's been our main focus for over 40 years, is looking at the failures of the Fourth Estate, not because the reporters can't necessarily tell the truth, but because the owners don't let them, and they frame certain narratives, as you just suggested. So bringing this up to the present sounds like a really important lesson to learn. Joel Ice, I really appreciate you taking time to share your thoughts. We really appreciate you participating in this project.
Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. This is part two of our two-part Kent State at 50 program. My next guest is filmmaker David Zeiger. Among his work, Sir, No Sir, a documentary about war resistance within the military itself, a movement he says is largely being written out of the corporate media's version of history.
I'm a documentary filmmaker. I have been for the last 30 years. And one of the films that I made about 10 years ago, a film called Sir, No Sir, that told the story of the GI movement against the Vietnam War, the story that's been very heavily suppressed since that time. In the wake of Kent State, I moved down to Killeen, Texas, which is the town just outside of Fort Hood. And I, along with several vets and other civilian anti-war activists, worked in a coffee house called the Oleo Strut, which was part of a network of coffee houses that were anti-war coffee houses that were outside of military bases throughout the U.S. and even in cities around the world. And these became centers of GIs organizing, active duty GIs organizing against the war, against racism in the military, in support of the anti-war movement, in support of the Black Panther Party, et cetera, et cetera. Hundreds of newspapers were published and distributed by GIs themselves. At Fort Hood, it was called the Fatigue Press. And I spent 2 years down there working with a pretty interesting variety of people, including a demonstration on Armed Forces Day, which we renamed Armed Forces Day in 1971, with close to 2,000 active duty GIs marching against the war under threat of court-martial, et cetera, right outside the gates of Fort Hood. And that really formed my understanding of a lot of things. And that's what the stories that I told in that film.
Well, David Zeiger, filmmaker, Vets for Peace. What does May 4th, 1970 mean to you?
I had gone to Cuba on what was called the Vence Ramos Brigade in the winter of 1970. The Vence Ramos Brigade were these organized groups of radicals and a whole variety of folks from the U.S. who went to Cuba to help cut sugarcane for a massive sugarcane harvest goal. And we spent 3 months in Cuba cutting sugarcane and then traveling around the country. And then we came back, we were brought back on a ship that landed up in Nova Scotia. And a friend of mine and I then hitchhiked down. And this was, I believe we landed a couple days before May 1st. Because first thing we did was we hitchhiked to Yale, New Haven, where there was a huge rally, both in support of Bobby Seale, who'd been indicted, and also against the invasion of Cambodia, which had happened a few days before that, and a call for a national student strike. You know, so my friend and I, we were heading back to Los Angeles, and we went to the rally at Yale, and then we started hitchhiking across the country. And at one point, and I didn't realize this until after, that we were in Ohio, and the interstate was just crowded with military vehicles, National Guard vehicles coming and going. And seeing that, we hightailed it out of there. And I think it was after that that we learned about what had happened, because it's hard to remember how you learned about things going on back then. There was no internet, of course, but that's what happened. And then shortly after that, I went right down to Killeen, Texas to work with the GI movement.
How do you see the Kent State massacre of May 4, 1970? How do you see Kent State influencing the things that happened both at the time and then again up to date?
I've been researching for several years now a film about the events of summer of 1970, what followed Kent State and the killings at Jackson State also. And my focus of what my research has been is what the Nixon administration was doing. And a key thing was Nixon created a commission called the President's Commission on Campus Unrest. It was actually created by Ehrlichman, who was the liberal in the Nixon administration. And they developed this kind of roadshow where this commission was traveling around the country. The prelude to this is that at this time, not only Nixon, but a whole lot of people in positions of power in the country really believed that Kent State marked the beginning of the insurrection, the beginning of the storming of the White House. Nixon met with, I think, 20 university presidents in the wake of Kent State. And according to H.R. Haldeman's diaries, he said the presidents were terrified. The thing that they said, and this is very significant, and I think this is true, is that The moderates on campus, who were the majority students, were now doing what the radicals were doing prior to that. In other words, the moderates had gone over to the radical position. The statistics are stunning. There were 30 or 40 ROTC buildings burned down. 30 states sent out the National Guard. It was the biggest student strike in history. On the University of New Mexico campus, students had taken over the library, had taken over the interstate, and the New Mexico National Guard, when they were called out, they weren't given bullets because they didn't want to have another Kent State. So they attacked the students with bayonets and sent about a dozen students to the hospital with bayonet wounds. This kind of thing was rolling, barreling down in the country, and really was only stopped by the fact that the school year ended. I mean, the majority of universities were closed because of the student strike. The Nixon administration spent the summer trying to figure out, what are we going to do about this? And along with the President's Commission on Campus Unrest, the FBI was recruiting and sending out about 1,000 additional agents just on the campuses alone. 36 states passed pretty draconian laws outlawing student dissent, basically saying anything that disrupts the campus is grounds for either arrest and or expulsion. Hundreds of students were expelled at that point, and a fairly significant number of assistant professors and professors were either fired or kind of forced out of their positions. All of this to solidify and emphasize really the lesson that was hanging over everyone's heads, which was, if you get out of hand, you will be killed with no consequences. Really, the student movement as a movement died then. The fall had some of the quietest times on campuses. There was still a massive anti-war movement, but there was no national coordination. There was no leadership in that sense. Ironically, at the time when there was the biggest explosion on campuses, there was really no national leadership that could take that anywhere. There was a very effective clamping down on the campuses and on the student movement. This coincided with the midterm elections, the 1970 elections, which was when the law and order slogan became very sharp in the Nixon camp. It was a complicated situation. I think there's a lot that can be learned from it, particularly the fact that when there was this huge uprising of students, there was no leadership, there was no coordination, there was no way to take it even further. I know there are people out there who say, well, it went too far. That was actually part of the message that came across from the Scranton Commission. The National Guard had no reason to open fire, and they shouldn't have opened fire. But the other part of their message was, if you get too radical, it's going to mess things up. And there are a lot of people that kind of bought into that line, in my view, wrongly, didn't go far enough.
Yeah, and it seems, David Zeiger, then to now, we've had a hard time seeing a sustained social justice movement, certainly an anti-imperial, anti-war movement in the last 50 years. You know, there was an anti-war movement in Iraq, like 2003. You know, there was some really significant anti-war protests, but then, as you recall, they dissipated.
That kind of harkens back to my film, Sir No Sir, and to the story of the GI movement, mm-hmm. which I think is an important story maybe to tell in this context, which is that there was a very effective campaign, and it wasn't like a coordinated conspiracy or something, but in the 1970s and really ratcheted up in the 1980s, there was a campaign that involved politicians. There were Hollywood films, you know, the Rambo films, et cetera, that put out the line that the Vietnam War was lost because the American people turned on the soldiers. And the soldiers were bravely fighting the war. Over 50,000 were killed. They came back. They were spat on by the students. They were vilified. They were called baby killers. And this narrative really took hold in a huge way, pushed very strongly by, you know, all the way from the right-wing veterans organizations to Hollywood to politicians. And it became pretty much the accepted narrative on what happened during the Vietnam War. And it's a lie. It's a total lie. On two different fronts. From the front of the soldiers, all of the services had a huge anti-war movement going on in it during the war, began as early as 1965, 1966, and hit a pinnacle in 71, which was right around the time that Nixon pulled out the ground troops and focused on the air war, during which there were pilots who refused to fly, there were people who refused to participate in the bombings, there were 300 plus different anti-war newspapers put out by GIs, there was a movement that involved thousands and thousands, and the military knew it, and the administrations knew it, and the people in the country knew it at the time. It was widely known that soldiers were joining the anti-war movement, that soldiers were refusing to fight, that soldiers were killing their commanders. There were national news reports about this. There were magazine articles. All of this stuff was very well known, that the military was crumbling under the weight of anti-war sentiment among the soldiers. Well, all of that has been buried since then by this mythology that the soldiers came home and the students spat on them. There's a wonderful book by Jerry Lemke, who was a Vietnam vet who came home, became a professor. And when the first Gulf War happened in 1990, these stories about spitting and about how the soldiers were vilified, you know, got huge. And Jerry, by the way, wrote his book, The Spitting Image, then, in which he did an investigation and he found not one single verifiable instance and just wild stories being told all over the place. And that first Gulf War under the first Bush, there were also massive demonstrations against invading. Once the invasion took place, this mythology of we have to support our soldiers, we can't do the anti-war movement did back in the Vietnam War days, it put this huge weight on the anti-war movement and it pretty much killed it. And the same thing happened with the invasion of Iraq. 2003, I remember sitting in meetings, planning demonstrations and people saying, look, we cannot demonstrate against the soldiers. We have to make sure we don't do what they did in the Vietnam War, whatever that meant. I mean, there was no such thing as demonstrating against the soldiers, but it gave this massive opening for this idea that once our boys, once American troops are in harm's way, anything you do, you'd be accused of endangering them. Also folds in with this idea that American lives are more important than any other lives, that our boys are more important than people anywhere else in the world.
David Zeiger, thank you so much for taking time to talk about Kent State and talk about your other thoughts about how Kent State still matters and lessons we could be learning from it. I really appreciated your time today.
Glad to be on it. War can't give life, it can only take it away. Oh, war! Good God, y'all. What is it good for? Absolutely. Nothing. Say it again. War. Oh, 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 Lord. What is it good for? Absolutely. Nothing. Listen to me.
This is the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. Up next in our Kent State special is Ira Shore. At the time of the Kent State massacre, Shore was a graduate student and anti-war activist in Madison, Wisconsin. He recently retired from the City University of New York after 48 years of teaching there. As we spoke about Kent State and its aftermath, one of the topics he brought up was the sweeping reaction of conservative political forces. He also noted that many of the movements for social change that began in the 1960s and 70s are still very active today. Here is author and critical pedagogy scholar, Ira Shore.
I was a student in the 60s, very involved in the anti-war movement and civil rights movement and the emergence of the women's rights movement, then with the April 22nd when Earth Day started. So it was a great time to be young, because it suddenly seemed like so much was happening and so much was possible. And it was so thrilling to be surrounded by thousands and thousands of people your age who were determined that a better world was possible and that we were actually going to make it happen and that we could end the ugly, illegal war in Vietnam, which was costing so many lives of the Vietnamese and American soldiers, and that we could stop the pollution of the earth and save our planet, that we could end the ugly racism that had tormented America for so many centuries. We thought we were going to join together as white folks and folks of color, and we had a chance now to march together and be instrumental in making this ugliness end, and that we were beginning to recognize what patriarchy was all about and how male supremacy was another distortion of happy human relations and very unjust. We had to do something about that. So it was a time when there was so much to do and so much to learn, and we were all growing as fast as we could, but we were all very, very young and immature, and we really lacked adult supervision. There were very few grown-ups around, adults, who could help us put things in perspective and teach us. So if we found an older professor, we all sat there and listened. There were a handful. So mostly we were on our own. So there was a lot of anti-war activity, of course, in Madison, Wisconsin, where I went to graduate school. The other things happened. I took part in the formation of the Teaching Assistants Association in 1969, which was the first graduate teaching union of assistants in America. We went on strike, and we were demanding a good contract and so on, like labor folks do. Our strike was in the spring of 1970, just before the terrible, terrible massacre at Kent. It was a very busy time, and so I was in the middle of a very important long-term strike. And we were having to decide what to negotiate, what to do, how to blockade doors and this and that. Then the invasion of Cambodia suddenly erupted, and the Nixon administration was escalating the war in a very dramatic way. So a whole new round of anti-war protests also cycled in. And in the middle of all of it, the terrible, terrible news arrived from Kent that four students, Allison, Sandy, Jeff, and Bill had been murdered, and nine others had been shot and were badly injured, and we were all in shock. It was terrible. It was hard to believe that such an atrocity could happen, and we knew that those students were not armed and were not a danger to the guardsmen, who were very well armed and so on. So there was a great deal of anger and outrage and sadness and disbelief and so on. So like many campuses around the country, several hundred campuses in America went on strike at that time. And there were student strikes, hundreds of places all around the nation. And Madison was one of those places. And for several nights, it was a war zone. And the police, they did not shoot, they did not fire weapons, but they did fire an enormous amount of tear gas. So the whole area was very, very toxic as you ran through it and got your eyes and your skin burned and this and that. So that went on for a few nights, and then when it was over, mailboxes had been ripped off their foundations, and garbage cans from the streets were thrown all over the place. Windows of various stores had been smashed and so on. Things looked like a war zone in response to the Kent State massacre and also to the invasion of Cambodia. The campus at Madison had been several times and was again occupied by National Guardsmen. And this time, they showed up in very large numbers and stood guard with drawn bayonets on their rifles. So it was more ominous than it had been before. I think that was like a very widespread experience for all us young people who were involved in the movements of the time. It left an indelible memory and an unforgettable mark on our character that we were now living in a society ready to murder its own citizens, especially its young people who were in opposition, which had gotten to the point where the status quo could no longer tolerate the level of opposition it was facing. It had been on the defensive in the civil rights movement, and it was on the defensive in the anti-war movement, and now we had a rising Chicano movement, we had a rising ecology movement. This was a very dangerous time for the status quo and the powers that be. And they were readying their own offensive to take their offensive. And in some ways, the terrible crime, this massacre at Kent State, was like the curtain opening on the Empire Strikes Back. And now we would have to deal with a much more aggressive status quo. In April 1975, when Saigon fell, we felt that we had won at terrible cost to American soldiers, 58,000 dead, 1,300 American nurses killed in Vietnam, 1 million Vietnamese killed, And then we had to add in lives such as the four people who were killed at Kent State. It was a terrible cost. But in 75, we forced an end to the war. And it was a great time to feel like in our youth, we took risks and we had forced the status quo to retreat. And then at the same time, the status quo struck back and began a whole different campaign to retake control of its own society. I wrote about this in a book called Culture Wars. It came out in the middle of the 80s to study how the tables were turned on the movements of the 60s and how what I call the conservative restoration was initiated and organized by the folks from the top. The opposition never sleeps. It's like rust. And that we had in the 70s the beginning of a very vigorous anti-war movement and a movement in favor of solar power. And I remember marching at various nuclear plants in the end of the 70s to get them to shut down. Then in the 1980s, there began a very, very serious gay movement to demand treatment for the AIDS crisis and then to demand gay rights. And that continued for the next 20 years. So it's important to remember that in the middle of the empire striking back and using its formidable resources to regain control of all institutions of society, that opposition remained. And many of us who came out of the anti-war movement and who mourned those who were shot and murdered at Kent State, we continued. We continued for the last 50 years to try to make a difference and try to continue opposition and build a just society. The mass media has chosen not to highlight us or to make it apparent to all of us just how many of us are busily at work building the just world that many of us imagined in 1970. We've built an environmental movement that's international. We also had some very strenuous oppositions to both Iraq wars. And then there was this phenomenon of Occupy that erupted in September of 2011. And eventually about 700 American cities saw occupations of various kinds, as well as places all around the world. And it changed the language, the discourse of our society. We now routinely talk about the 1% and the 99%. And we have a meme that allows us quickly to indicate who's responsible for the troubles that we have and for a society that is looting the national wealth for the favor of the 1% at the top and keeping us all frozen at the bottom in declining conditions. Why are we so unprepared for this pandemic? Why are so many of our fellow Americans unemployed and also homeless? 100,000 children every year in New York City experience homelessness, school children. We've learned a lot and we have a new language. I trace it all back to that time when sadly we lost lots of people in various ways and the four beautiful young people at Kent State, but they laid a foundation that many of us never forgot and that many of us are determined to continue. There is so much opposition now in so many dimensions. There's the Me Too. In education, there's so much disregard for the testing industry and for the invasion of high tech to steal the local school budgets and the racist tracking that established the school to prison pipeline and so on. So there's so much opposition that if we added it all together, it would be a very formidable mass movement. Even though we are all moving in the same direction, we're not moving together in the same direction. If that begins to emerge, and I call it consolidation in the next period, we're going to see a whole lot. Now, one inkling of this came from Occupy 10 years ago, when this group took over a park in the Wall Street area of New York City. And then in the ensuing weeks, 700 other cities saw occupations. There was something waiting to happen. And now we have opposition growing in so many dimensions that it was all consolidated for a time under Bernie Sanders' campaign. As Noam Chomsky said, Bernie Sanders was anathema to the elite, not because he ran for president, but because he built an oppositional movement about class inequality, class oppression, the school-to-prison pipeline, the need for a Green New Deal, Medicare for all, and the scandal of the healthcare system and so on. He was talking about forbidden topics in forbidden ways, and that's why he was forced out of the campaign. But he demonstrated that it's possible to get a movement going around these ideas. The words neoliberalism and socialism are in circulation like never before in the last 40 years. That's a real accomplishment. what we have to do now is keep going and follow through and find each other and develop a lot of patience and tolerance for our differences. Because all these groups that come together are going to have different identities. They're going to be from different locales. They'll be involved in different work. They'll be from different genders and so on and different colors. And so we have to be very patient with how we develop a dialogue that brings us closer. That's an adult job that we're capable of now, I think.
I agree, Ira. And I really appreciate your insights, not just on Kent, but taking it up to the present for us and even shining a brighter light into the future.
Thanks a lot.
This is the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. This is part two of our two-part Kent State at 50 program. To learn more, you can go to truthtribunal.org to see all 4 hours of interviews for free. My next guest is David Swanson. He's executive director of World Beyond War and is also involved with Veterans for Peace, Roots Action, and other organizations. Although too young to remember Kent State, he had important observations about its place in our history. Here's my conversation with David Swanson.
I think it was an example that shocked some people at the time, even more so than Jackson State and other similar tragedies, because they saw the U.S. government, for whatever justification, shooting the people who matter rather than the people who do not matter. And you see a similar dawning with the current coronavirus pandemic. They will literally say, the mayor of Las Vegas will sacrifice the citizens of her city as an experiment to see how many people die. The Congress members from Indiana and the lieutenant governor from Texas. So we'll kill people as long as we get the economy going, which is how the U.S. government has always, and before the U.S. government was even a government, has talked about Native Americans and African Americans and, the 95% of the world that's outside of the United States. But to have them so recklessly, casually, sadistically almost deal with the lives of the people who matter, the people who supposedly all the justifiable, glorious mass murder abroad and elsewhere and in the wrong neighborhoods, is for the benefit of. I think that shocks people. I don't think we are terribly likely to see an exact duplicate of what happened at Kent State today. I think both sides have varied their tactics considerably. And the powers that be have long since learned not to attract the media. In fact, to get rid of the media is a far better tactic than shooting people, which hurts their cause. Now, there are people on the side of peace and justice who haven't learned that throwing rocks at windows hurts their cause. Everybody has to learn this lesson at some point. But for the most part, I think the people giving orders to the National Guard have long since learned what is counterproductive for their agenda.
How do you see Kent State sitting historically as part of our collective consciousness and memory of who we are as a society?
I think it plays a big role, and through music and drama and art, it's played a particularly big role in people's memory of that era and in the role that the peace movement back here in the United States played in opposing and eventually ending the war on Vietnam, which, we now have a very, very limited understanding in the general U.S. public of what happened in Vietnam. Almost nobody has remotely, within orders of magnitude, an idea of how many people were killed on each side and what happened and why. But people do have a sense that the war ended in part because of what the Vietnamese did, in part because of what the U.S. troops did, deserting, resisting, fragging, etc., and in part because of what the public did back in the United States, that the peace movement had a major impact in combination with other justice movements and the impeachment of Nixon and so forth. And people remember that. And people remember that and are aware of that, even if they've been so brainwashed that they're completely unaware of any other successes or victories. You could go back in recent years and point out to people the instances where there was a huge demand for a war on Iran and people stopped it. There was going to be an all-out carpet bombing of Syria 7 years ago. Didn't happen. Everybody just sort of looks back to the Vietnam period. Something got done. And then Bush wanted to attack Iraq, and we said no, and we failed. And Iraq got attacked anyway, and we are powerless, and we should crawl under our beds and slit our throats. And the fact that that war was made illegal, that the United Nations was moved, that numerous nations were moved, that the public was moved, that it was made so shameful that all you had to say to Congress members in the decades after was, you launch this next war, you're going to be that jerk who voted for another Iraq. And it was, you know, hanging around their neck like an albatross. And I think the Vietnam peace era has taught people the correct lesson that the peace movement can do something. But it's taught people all kinds of incorrect lessons about what that must look like, to the point where you have the Democrats in Congress trying to create a draft registration for women as an equal right, a feminist demand for the equal right to be forced against your will to go kill and die for ExxonMobil.
Well, I think getting the word out that this is happening is key. I certainly know that you do your part in that regard, but it doesn't seem to be part of the national conversation, unfortunately. And now with the coronavirus, that put a lens through which we're looking at everything that's happening. Of course, one thing that could come out of that lens would be puts into perspective how completely senseless a lot of these wars are in the first place.
If you can scale back the weapons shows and the war rehearsals because you don't want the troops to get sick or become ill, why do you need to start them up again afterwards? If you can have a global ceasefire, and I know it's not been realized yet, and it's not complete, and it's an extravaganza of hypocrisy where every government wants a ceasefire for everyone else on Earth, but not them. But if you, to the extent that we're getting a ceasefire, if you can end these wars, why in the world start them up again if they're this inevitable force of nature that you shouldn't bother trying to stop, but then you can stop them because there's this other crisis to be dealt with? What do you make of all the last resort language that started them in the first place? Obviously, something's not a last resort if all it takes is a distraction to put an end to it. And yet, we actually, thus far, have seen increased military spending, increased militarism, and in some cases, increased fighting and bombing during this pandemic. And a lot of the increased spending, including in the United States, is panic in face of the fear that the pandemic is going to reduce spending by maybe next year. We will see. But as of now, we've got, you know, weapons production, people working in weapons factories in the United States labeled essential workers. Essential to what? We got a shortage of food workers. We got a shortage of health workers. We got a shortage of people aiding those suffering because of this pandemic. And we're treating weapons production for dozens of dictatorships and so-called democracies around the globe, not just for the sainted U.S. government, as essential. We have to have this moment actually be the shift where we start really thanking doctors and nurses and farmers and food workers for their service and stop thanking people for a service over something that's actually a murderous crime rather than a service. We have to shift from seeing weapons production and mass murder and mass destruction as essential to anything and start envisioning what a department or agency of actual defense would look like. It was actually defending against real dangers like nuclear apocalypse, like climate collapse. And this is a moment to try it, where we're seeing some real change in environmental policies. We're certainly seeing change in rhetoric around war. But we've got such a societal problem with acceptance of war that everyone's talking about the coronavirus as a war enemy.
We never seem to grow tired of the war metaphor. Robin Anderson just wrote about this at FAIR. Andrew Austin's written about it. It's something that we can't seem to escape. We declare war on everything, including the virus.
On one and the same day, I read an article proposing that NATO declare war on the coronavirus and another article declaring that NATO was the top candidate for the next Nobel Peace Prize. This is the sort of madness that we're living in. We have this government that as soon as you hit it with a real threat, with a pandemic that causes actual damage, it collapses immediately, is revealed as a naked emperor, as a clownish Keystone Cop, corrupt, incompetent, buffoonish circus. So how is it that that same government has been so professionally and awe-inspiringly holding off the Russian and Iranian and North Korean and Venezuelan menaces? Well, because they aren't real. Because it's easy to constantly defeat imaginary threats, right? You know, Venezuela's military budget is something like 0.0001% of the U.S. Iran's is approaching 1%. Of the US. Russia's is about 8. China's is 30% or so of the US budget and predictably goes up whenever the US does and down whenever the US does. But these are imaginary threats. They're not real threats. And we've got to stop this worshipful, troop-obsessed, flag-obsessed, music and weaponry-obsessed reverence for these buffoons who can't handle a health crisis. They aren't handling the evil Iranians who are about to kill us all if Donald Trump weren't there to save us. The Iranians just want to be left the hell alone and aren't threatening anybody and never were. This is what we have to try to realize.
Neoliberalism has certainly laid bare, the COVID crisis has laid bare the failures of neoliberal policies over the last half century plus. You've already been going into the final questions. Been asking everybody who's been participating about making peace with the massacre at Kent State. And of course, that means different things to different people. And so there's been very, you know, different responses about what elements of it they make peace with, elements of it about which they don't believe they should be making peace with. But bringing it up more to the present in that regard, after 9/11, now during this pandemic, as you mentioned, just like our government hasn't stopped the military-industrial complex, we haven't seen an abatement of the trouncing of human rights, of civil rights, particularly on marginalized communities. So how would you define making peace with that and addressing the current challenges we face?
If making peace with something means something important to someone, I have no disagreement, but I don't have any interest myself in making peace with senseless murder. I would tend more to agree with Dr. King, who not too far in time away from that massacre suggested that we ought to be maladjusted to a society that is sick. We ought not to try to adjust ourselves or make peace with, we're living in what many people are increasingly recognizing as a permanent crisis headed toward a cliff. We've got environmental collapse approaching, if not beyond, the point of no return in various ways. And so talking about returning to normal from the coronavirus when the normal is an absolutely insane, mass murderous self-genocide, I don't want to make peace with that. I want to make panic. I want to make fear. I want to make anger. I want to make engagement. I want to make energy. I want to make dedication. I want to make enthusiastic, nonviolent, strategic engagement with trying to transform the world. I love listening to this little girl who's become this environmental leader, Greta Thunberg, who people tell her, you know, how they can help her be hopeful. And she tells them to shut up. I don't want to be hopeful. I don't want you to feel better. I want you to feel worse. I want you to help turn this world around before we destroy it.
Influence us to get busy. Just like, again, not forgetting 50 years ago, these young people were protesting the imperial wars in Vietnam that killed between 3 and 4 million people. These people were shot for trying to literally throw their bodies on the gears of the machine, going back to Savio. And that's what we need to be doing now. Would you say, David, we can't go out into the streets right now, right? But we really need to pick this up and not return to the normal that you just described.
Yeah, they were right. They were right, and their victory is not complete. And if we don't hurry up and complete it, we're done for. It's not optional. Do we understand now, if anyone didn't then, and I think many did, that if we don't kick the militarism habit and we don't stop the extraction and consumption and destruction of the earth, we're done for. It's not a choice. It's not a style. It's not a fashion preference. It's not a counterculture I want to be hip with. It's an absolute necessity for survival. And if you don't like the fact that about many things, the peace activists and the hippies were right, deal with it. It doesn't matter whether you like someone who agrees with you on an important point or not. It remains an important point. We have to develop a culture of peace and sustainability with regard to planet Earth, or we're not going to survive. The people protesting, the people who were shot at Kent State, were on the right side of that struggle.
Well, David Swanson, it's always good to catch up with you, and you always have a lot to offer in terms of perspective, and those lessons from history are more important maybe now than ever for us, as you just pointed out, that we really need to be turning the ship around, and we don't have a lot of time to do it. David Swanson, thanks so much for joining us for the Kent State Teach-In.
On our program today, we heard excerpts from interviews I did with four academics and anti-war activists about their thoughts on the Kent State Massacre 50 years later. To hear the full 4 hours of the interviews, go to truthtribunal.org, or you can see them linked at projectcensored.org. Thanks for tuning in.
Supporting human conditions, not free market propaganda and corrupt politicians, because they own by special interest groups that fund their campaign. That's why you hear this.
You've been listening to the Project Censored Show, established in 2010 by myself along with Peter Phillips. I'm the executive producer, Mickey Huff, of this program, also the host. Our co-host is Chase Palmieri. Anthony Fest, our senior producer. Our associate producer is Dennis Murphy. Thanks to you, our listeners, for tuning in. We'll see you next time.
About criminal minds, political ties, habitual lies, alibis, disguise, another guise of democracy, politics, and the apocalypse. Got the skies looking ominous.